Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Oksana Kisy, author of Survival as a Victory, Ukrainian Women in the Gulag, published in 2020 as part of Harvard Series in Ukrainian Studies, Ukrainian Research Institute, Harvard University. Oksana Kisy is a historian and anthropologist who works in Ukrainian women's history, feminist anthropology, oral history, and gender transformations in post-socialist societies. She's a senior research fellow at the Institute of Ethnology, National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine, and the president of the Ukrainian Association for Research in Women's History. Hello, Oksana.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining me today, and congratulations on the publication of this fascinating volume.
Thank you for inviting me to talk about my book.
The subtitle of the book is Ukrainian Women in the Gulag, and it makes the project unique and pioneering in many ways. And in the introduction, you specify some points. Not only does the research focus on a specific national ethnic group, it also emphasizes communities of women in the Gulag. As a rule, the Gulag studies would be associated with Russians or Soviets, and the majority of the studies would not specify women in particular. How does the book intervene with the previous Gulag studies? Also, how does it expand the current Gulag studies? And probably one more question here, how many Ukrainians, men and women, were detained in the Gulag?
Well, I consider my contribution to the Gulag studies threefold. First, my study makes Gulag history more human-centered, human-oriented. It also complements our knowledge on national and gender dimensions of prisoners' experiences. I've been using anthropological approach in my research on the Gulag as I attempted to shift the focus from institutional and political history of this penitentiary and repressive institution to more human-centered history, to explore experiences of those who constituted the Gulag population, the prisoners, actually. So I wanted to explore what happened to human beings, and more specifically to Ukrainian women in the captivity. The Gulag as an institution existed since 1930s, but the Gulag studies actually started only in the 90s after the Soviet archives, the archives of the Gulag and KVD archives became open to the scholars. And since the 90s, the Gulag studies made a tremendous progress and a substantial body of literature appeared. And the problem of the post-Soviet history writing on the Gulag is its main focus on the institution. And the researchers who studied the Gulag focused on its establishment, its evolution, its structure and management and functioning, its demography, its economy, and the number of prisoners and the number of victims. But they don't really explore the prisoners' lives in the captivity. And by the contrast, since the early 2000s, starting with the groundbreaking work of Anne Applebaum, Western scholars who studied the Gulag have been paying like more attention to the people in the camps, and they analyzed the inmates' social backgrounds and the health conditions and their diet and mortality rates and so on and so forth. And here I'd like to focus on the studies by Stephen Barnes and recent book by Golf Alexopoulos and Lynn Viola and Veronika Shapovalov and others who tried to focus more on human experiences. And they also examined the dehumanizing nature of the Gulag system and its impact on the Soviet society at large. But in both cases, however, there is too little written on gender peculiarities of women's experiences in the captivity, and the Ukrainians as an ethnic group slip out of scholar sites completely, as the majority of those studies are heavily based on the Russian memoirs, the memoirs written and published in Russian language. And my research brings both Ukrainians and female political prisoners to the front of the Gulag studies, exploring both gender and national dimensions of living through the long-term incarceration. And I'm trying to understand what was special about being a woman and being a Ukrainian in the captivity. And when it comes to the numbers, we have to be aware that Ukrainians made up to 20% of the Gulag population in the 40s and 50s. And in some special camps, they constituted about half of the inmates. So it was a large group. And women also constituted about one third of the inmates in post-war years. So the experiences of these two large groups of prisoners are really underrepresented in the Gulag studies, and very little has been written on everyday lives of women behind bars, except perhaps for the only book by Catherine Joluk and her solid research on Polish women in Soviet exile. And the Ukrainians are virtually invisible in major research on Gulag history. So I believe that we cannot just discard or neglect two large groups of prisoners if we aspire to reconstruct a comprehensive and accurate history of the Gulag. Like, more different voices are to be heard and taken into account, and that is what I try to do with my book.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Oksana. Yes, that's quite... shocking, I would say, 20% of all the Gulag prisoners. And this group, for some reason, was not visible for many years. Could you tell us a little bit about the fieldwork? What material was included? What archives were used? And what was the most challenging in this project?
For my study, I used about 150 women's firsthand accounts of surviving the Gulag. Most of the memories are ethnic Ukrainians predominantly from the western regions of Ukraine, who have been sentenced for real or alleged collaboration with the Ukrainian nationalist anti-Soviet underground during and after the Second World War. There are also some testimonies by the representatives of other nations, like Jewish, Russian, Polish, German women who spent long time with Ukrainian women in camps and recalled those experiences in their memoirs. The testimonies I use vary greatly in genre, from large and very detailed autobiographies to very brief letters, and to the oral history interviews recorded for different oral history projects. Those testimonies differ in size. Like, there are long and there are short ones. There are different styles of narration, and those memoirs have been produced in different times and for different purposes, sometimes for the family members only or for other audiences. They are published and unpublished. Some of them are preserved in oral history archives, attached to some museums. The others are preserved in family archives, and they are widely available for scholars. So sometimes it was quite difficult to access those memoirs, to include their those voices in my book. But despite all those differences, all that variety of texts I'm using, I believe that taken together, those memoirs complement and cross-verify each other, and they form as a kind of meta-narrative about women's experiences of the Gulag, a story that raises themes that are the most relevant for the women. They traces clearly universal subjects and standard situations, and they illustrate extremely similar experiences and concerns, regardless of the specific details. For me, it's not that much important what time women discuss or what specific camp they've been at the moment they recall. For me, it's much more important. What is really important is to understand what all the phenomena that were universal features of the camp life meant to the women, like hunger and cold and disease and debilitating labor and lack of clothing and filth and humiliation and violence and physical and emotional exclusion and homesickness and faith and separation from children and information isolation and so on and so forth. So I track how the women adapted, survived and resisted under these circumstances in order to understand what precisely helped them to save their physical health and sanity in the most critical moments of their imprisonment. So there are very different sources I'm using, but I believe that taken together, they could help us to reconstruct the story of Ukrainian women living through the Gulag.
You already touched upon some aspects with which Ukrainian women were confronted and with which they had to deal. There is another section in your book which focuses on religion. So would you tell us a little bit about how important, how significant religion was for the Ukrainian women and what religion manifestations prevailed?
Well, the Christian faith and religious practices, related religious practices behind bars, were extremely important for my subjects. And I already said that most of my narrators come from the Western Ukrainian regions, from Galicia, Bukovina, Transcarpathia, Volhynia, the territories which didn't belong to the Soviet Union. They were not under Soviet rule before the Second World War. And that means that those women have been raised in a very religious societies. They have not been exposed to the militant atheism policies of the Soviet regime. So their Christian faith and their religious practices were like integral parts of their daily lives. And their religiosity was one of the core elements of their personalities. So they were not prepared to give up their faith upon arrest. And despite strict prohibitions and severe penalties, women continued to pray individually and in groups. They procured and kept and used religious items like crosses and beads and prayer books, very rare, you know, items in the captivity. And they also made and used small icons. And they organized improvised divine masses and celebrated Easter and Christmas. And those activities took place on the regular basis. And they constituted an integral part of women's lives in the captivity, stiffening the spirit of those imprisoned women and enhancing their mental endurance. That was extremely important in terms of strengthening their souls. And in that relation, I'd like to stress one important aspect of those religious practices, which impressed me perhaps the most. In many cases, women took over the roles of a priest and a deacon and conducted liturgies, the divine masses. Paradoxically, under the circumstances of virtually total deprivation of civil rights and radical restraint of opportunities, These practices of improvised divine masses provided Ukrainian women with completely new, unique experiences of church service and religious leadership, or pastorate, or priesthood. As a matter of fact, never in their normal lives before the captivity, those women have had any chance to play a central or leading role in the crucial church ritual as a priest or as a deacon. That new religious experience, although induced by circumstances, may be understood as a kind of emancipation. For the first time, Ukrainian women have got access to a sphere and roles previously totally forbidden and closed to them. So remarkably, despite of awareness of transgressing the church norms, the former Gulag prisoners, those women, deeply religious women, they speak, they recall those experiences with pride and thrill, so they don't feel guilty for transgressing the church norms. And I find this really absolutely astonishing experience, which has to be explored in depth, perhaps by other scholars, but that is some kind of phenomenon.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there were some transgressions. However, there were still some topics which were tabooed while in the captivity. So what topics for the Ukrainian women in particular were tabooed still?
Well, no wonder that the subject of a woman's body and sexuality are among those the most taboo in the Ukrainian women's memoir. Those are the blind spots Ukrainian women extremely rarely talk about their bodies and sexuality in the captivity. And mentions of the loss of bodily integrity or of sexualized violence like forced nudity, body searches, voyeurism, not to mention sexual harassment or rape, are presented very tersely and filled with negative emotions. Even when they turn to this kind of subject matter, there is a noticeable self-censorship. Most often women limit themselves to just few short phrases like euphemism and so on. They really don't want to explore these topics. And this evasiveness probably resulted from traditional social norms of communication, as any public discussion of such intimate issues considered de mauvais ton. So for memoirists, it is problematic to verbalize such experiences in public. But on the other hand, it is very likely that the camp sexual experience was very traumatic and imbued with humiliation and feeling of shame and guilt. So the narrators prefer to avoid those topics altogether.
I would like to go back to the title of the book. So how can we conceptualize the notion of survival? There are a lot of layers that your research offers, gender, national, and existential. What interpretation of survival do you emphasize?
Effectively, the main goal of long-term sentences for political prisoners who opposed the Soviet regime was to isolate, to punish, and to re-educate or reforge them. And achieving that goal required the disintegration of a prisoner's self, the destruction of their basic social identity. And the erosion of their established value system and beliefs. And the objective of the Gulag system was to turn them into a homogeneous, amorphous human mass with no recognizable social identity, be that gender, nationality, religion, political persuasion, and so on. And the Gulag system used a variety of techniques like hunger, total control of behavior, harsh climate, backbreaking labor, unacceptable living conditions, isolation, and the absence of proper medical care, and so on. All this was intended to reduce the prisoner's interest to physical survival at any cost. So the prisoner's goal was to retain their humanity, to remain a human being in a full sense, not only to preserve one's body from destruction, but also to maintain sanity and to sustain one's core social identities, gender, national, religious, and others. By looking closely at different sides of camp life, I attempt to uncover what was important or even decisive for their survival, what helped these women to save their lives, their physical health, but also to preserve their individuality and sanity from complete disintegration. Some of the issues that my book specifically looks at are the means of supporting and representing those key social identities like gender, nation, and religion, and corresponding value systems in seemingly trivial daily activities and behaviors of Ukrainian political prisoners. The main objective of my study is to uncover and examine those little noticed yet effective manifestations of the women's agency that helped these women to resist the destructive impact of the system on their bodies and minds, and to remain a human being, a woman, a Ukrainian, a Christian, and so on, under the conditions where the opportunities, rights, and resources were limited to the extreme. Those included such trivial activities as housekeeping, for instance, group singing, different arts and crafts like embroidering and drawing and poetry writing, or personal hygiene, and many others, quite typical female practices which turned into survival skills and tools in the captivity. Through practicing their normative gender, national, and religious activities, women were able to maintain those identities and thus preserve their personalities in the soul-crushing machine of the Gulag.
The Gulag is inseparable from the totalitarian regime. What do the Ukrainian women's practices in the Gulag tell us about the totalitarian regime?
The Ukrainian women's experiences in the Gulag actually questioned the very ability of the Soviet regime to establish total control over its citizens, even over the most disenfranchised of them. The guards and the camp's overseers could not possibly constantly control all the aspects of the everyday lives of the prisoners, especially when in the barracks. And despite of the countless prohibitions and restrictions and severe punishments for violations, the prisoners led a hidden life in their barracks, turning them into a space of so-called collective privacy. Those forbidden pleasures included, as I said, praying, singing, and versifying, and embroidering, and relating personal stories and literary works, and teaching one another, and so on. In this way, I believe a barrack became that living space where a prisoner counterculture was born, and it took shape and evolved, and that allowed the women to nurture and to maintain their threatened social identities and resist the destructive effects of the imprisonment. Within a barrack, women were able to control at least something in their lives in the captivity. In barracks, women lived in a parallel reality that functioned according to the rules of normal lives. They remained normal women while in the barrack. And so this space effectively undermined the aim of total control through those minor but permanent and large-scale transgressions of the camp's rules and regulations. Women actually exposed the failure of totalitarian regime to exercise a control, a total control, its inability to subjugate all of its antagonists. So through all those minor gendered practices I listed and I explored in my book, women actually proved that the totalitarian regime is not totalitarian, that they can remain free citizens inside their souls, and they continue to resist by practicing their normal social identities in the Gulag, which aim to destroy those identities.
Mm-hmm. I just have a quick follow-up question on this. You said that the Ukrainian women try to maintain this normal life. And I'm curious about this notion of the normal or normalcy. Wasn't it somehow, however, shifted by those practices that the women had to engage with, as you, for example, pointed out, with their religious practices when women were acting as priests, for instance?
Of course, those practices in the barracks, they were not totally normal. But that was a semblance of normalcy. But that was something which reminded women who they are. At least they tried to remain the normal women, following the certain gender stereotypes and the ideas of normative femininity they've been socialized within. So they tried to continue to behave like a normal woman, a normal Ukrainian, a normal Christian should behave. They tried to treat one another as Christians. They tried to treat one another as family members, for instance. They cared for one another. They maintained a kind of a hominess in their barracks, trying to domesticate them, to turn them into a substitute of a home, to decorate them with those barracks, and so on. So by practicing their identities through those like normal practices, through activities they consider it to be the part of their normative identities, they maintain those identities, although it wasn't the same as in their normal lives before detention. So I would say that the normative femininity as a complex of ideas and norms about what a normal woman is supposed to be, by continuing to behave like everything is okay, like they remain the same women, the same Ukrainians, the same Christians, they continue to insist that although their normal life has fallen apart and they found themselves in the totally alien and hostile environment, but inside themselves they remain the same human beings and they continue to follow the rules and the norms of their culture. And that was, I believe, the core of their survival, to stick to their value systems and to their beliefs, and to continue, despite all the circumstances, to practice what they consider to be the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Your book covers a lot of material, a lot of information, and you also pointed out that there is still so much to discover and uncover in terms of the Gulag studies. Is your current project in any way connected with this book?
My current project is also about the everyday life in the camps, but those are completely different kinds of camps. Since like 2 years ago, I started a project about Ukrainian refugees who fled Ukraine at the end of the Second World War when the Soviet, the Red Army approached, who headed to the West, and who spent several years in the specific setting called the displaced persons camps, the DP camps. Ukrainians who didn't want to live under the Soviet regime, who were fed up with the Soviet regime, and who really wanted to continue their lives and who looked for better chances in the Western democracies, and who left Ukraine following the Nazi army who was like escaping the approaching Red Army. And they spent many years in those camps, and those were the communities which functioned in a very specific way, self-organized way, and the civic society existed there. And my research is focused on the everyday lives of those people who resided in those communities, starting from housing and provision and like everyday issues, and up to their spiritual life, Christianity, celebrations, political activities, and so on and so forth, because that was a very vibrant life and very lively communities who, for perhaps for the first time in the Ukrainian history, tried to build their communal life according to their ideas of what is what's supposed to be a Ukrainian nation state, although on a smaller scale. So that was my subject. I have conducted several dozens of interviews with former DP residents who currently are the citizens of Canada and the United States, and I also try to explore the periodicals published in those camps, and I'm going also to work on the archives, which are preserved in North American Ukrainian institutions. So hopefully I will write another book about other types of camps, which are not that dark story of suffering, but to the contrary, a story of hope.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, I look forward to reading your new books, your new projects on these issues. Well, thank you so much, Oksana, for this conversation today, and thank you for this research that gives visibility to the Ukrainian women detained in the Gulag, as well as thank you for, again, taking our attention back to the individual and to the survival techniques that the individual may somehow engage with while being in these extreme situations. Thank you so much for your research, Oksana.
Thank you for inviting me.
Today I spoke with Oksana Kis, author of Survival as Victory: Ukrainian Women in the Gulag, published in 2020 as part of Harvard Series in Ukrainian Studies, Ukrainian Research Institute, Harvard University. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.